Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Public Policy Institute of California is releasing its newest statewide survey. We're getting a first look at where Californians stand on the upcoming recall election, their outlook on the pandemic, and vaccine distribution. Plus, we also have a new National Youth Poet Laureate, and she's from Sacramento. Alexandra Nguyen will join us about an accomplishment in an entirely new spotlight following Amanda Gorman, and she'll share her powerful work. Later in the hour, we'll get a sense of how Music in the Mountains is celebrating 40 years in Grass Valley. But first, rental relief or rental assistance was one of the many ways the government stepped in to try and help people who lost their jobs at the beginning of the pandemic. There was also an eviction moratorium that was extended for people to avoid losing their homes during the pandemic. Many of the rental dollars that have been allocated to helping renters and landlords have been untouched. In fact, only about 30% of those funds have been used up, according to a recent article by the LA Times. Plus, low-income housing continues to be scarce as time goes on. Joining us now to help us break it all down is CAP Radio news reporter Chris Nichols. Welcome to Insight, Chris.
Hey, Vicki. Good morning. Great to be here.
You know, Chris, there has been a sizable amount of state funding and federal funding dedicated to this issue. So how much money are we talking about and who is eligible for it?
That's right. There is really a lot of money available, and the problem has been accessing it. Altogether, California's rental assistance program has about $1.4 billion in federal stimulus funds that the state plans to hand out, and another $1.2 billion that cities and counties are making available. And locally, the Sacramento Housing and Redevelopment Agency is in charge of distributing rental assistance. I spoke with them this morning. They are still accepting applications. And this all comes from a bill that Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law back in January called SB 91. It provides funds for low-income tenants who, because of the pandemic, have not been able to pay their rent due to a lost job or another hardship. And the way the program works is that both a renter and their landlord have to apply for the money. And if approved, the state pays the landlord 80% of a tenant's past due rent from April last year through the end of March this year. And then the landlord is required to forgive the remaining unpaid rent.
I mean, that seems like a significant amount of support. But yesterday, a coalition of housing advocates released a report saying that only a fraction of this money has actually been paid out in the year that you're talking about. Tell us more about this coalition and what they found.
That's right. The report found California has paid out less than 5% of the federal relief money requested so far by renters. So altogether, that's just $20 million that have been distributed and $473 million that's been requested. We checked with the state and they confirmed those numbers are correct.
$20 million out of $473 million. Why have so few dollars been awarded?
Yeah, it's a really eye-opening number for the small size of it. The report by the housing advocates, which includes the group Housing Now California, they found that many renters, they're just having a hard time with the application process. They say it's lengthy and complicated. It requires more than a dozen pieces of documentation. And in some cases, they say there are language barriers. Also, some renters don't have the internet access needed to apply online. And finally, some renters say that there's another stumbling block. They say that's their landlord. Their landlord maybe hasn't cooperated with the application process to receive the 80% back rent payment. A spokesperson for the California Apartment Association, which represents landlords, told me that's not what they're hearing. They say their clients are eager to receive these funds. Many landlords have also gone without revenue over the past year.
This impacts so many people across the state. Chris, tell us about some of the tenants who are actually speaking out about their challenges in applying for the rent relief funds.
Jalen Bailey was one renter who spoke during a press conference held by the housing groups yesterday. The freelance writer from Pasadena said, she lost work during the pandemic and has struggled to secure any rent relief funds. Bailey said her application was actually approved by Los Angeles County, but the release of the money is contingent upon her landlord participating And so far, they haven't.
We're at a loss. We don't know where we are in the system. We don't know if our landlord has outright rejected the program. There's just been no communication. So we are essentially in limbo. And we're unsure what's going to happen July 1. We have no idea. Yeah. So we live with that every day.
Sacramento renter and daycare worker Yolanda Flores also spoke at the press conference about her situation. She's a member of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, or ACE. Flores spoke in Spanish, and her comments are followed by a translation from Insight producer Cynthia Lopez.
Yo soy Yolanda. A mí me ha estado ayudando hace.
I'm Yolanda. ACE has been helping me. They helped me fill out an application for rental assistance, and well, they have helped me out a lot, but now I'm waiting to see if the application went through. I had never sought out rental assistance because I've never liked the idea. I've always worked, and I've always had to pay my rent myself. But now with everything going on with the pandemic, all plans seem to go away. Not just mine, but everyone's. And well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, the renter from Pasadena specifically mentioned the date of July 1st. That is just around the corner. Remind us why that date is so important for so many renters in the state.
Right. She mentioned that date because California's eviction moratorium expires on June 30th, the day before. Some lawmakers and advocates are pushing for it to be extended. They say the complexity of the rental application and the fact that so little money has gone out so far, those are both key reasons that the moratorium should be extended.
Right. I mean, 5% of funding that was actually allocated. What has the state said about why so little money has actually gone out to people?
Well, Russ Heimrich is with the state's housing agency, and he says the distribution is slow because the state wants to prevent fraud and waste.
We're very, very mindful of the fact that we don't want a duplication of benefits. We don't want people applying for rent relief who aren't entitled to it. So we've been doing a lot of the security functions. We've gotten better and faster at that.
And Heimrich did say that in addition to the $20 million that's gone out so far, California has another $122 million in rent relief funds that are pending approval and should be distributed soon.
All right, so an additional $100 million pending approval. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio's reporter, Chris Nichols, about the state of affordable housing and how renters have been impacted. Chris, you also did some reporting on another eye-opening study that came out recently. And this one focused specifically on Sacramento County, the lack of affordable housing for renters. What did the study find?
Well, this is a study by the nonprofit California Housing Partnership, and you're right, it has some pretty startling findings. One is that Sacramento County has a shortfall of nearly 60,000 affordable homes for its lowest income renters. It also found that rent in Sacramento County now averages about $1,400 a month, and that residents have to earn at least $27 per hour or twice the state's minimum wage just to afford that average rent.
Yeah, and really just hitting that home in your reporting, you're saying like these are retail workers, janitors, childcare workers, home health aides that now are struggling to pay rent. You also spoke with renters in Oak Park about their struggles fighting affordable housing. What did they have to say?
I did. And some of those professions you mentioned, just to be clear, the report found that their income is not even close to that $27 per hour. But we spoke with a renter in Oak Park, Erica Jaramillo, and she is a housing advocate, and she's also a board member for an anti-displacement group. But at the end of July, her own lease is up at her Oak Park home of 6 years. Her landlord is selling right in the middle of this really crazy real estate market that we're in Sacramento, and there's no guarantee that the new owner will extend her lease. And Jaramillo worries that she'll need to pay hundreds more every month to stay in the neighborhood. I spoke with her about that looming deadline.
It creates panic for me. I get anxiety about it. I mean, it's like the only thing I'm thinking about the rest of the day because all I have in the back of my head is July 31st, July 31st.
Yeah. I mean, and even in your reporting, you were just talking about the home sales in Oak Park and how much they have increased, not only just the timeline of a home being off the market, you know, going from, you know, just a couple weeks, to even a week, but also the median sales price of a home in Oak Park is up like 600% from a decade ago. You know, I guess what do city leaders have to say about this report?
Right. And it's just been a drastic change. You're right. Well, as far as Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, we have some sound on how he described this report's findings.
Both stunning and not surprising. We've known about this for a long time, and it is not just a community problem here in Sacramento. It is our state's biggest problem.
And Steinberg, even with his comments there, he does say he's more encouraged now than in the past. He says that's because there are more federal and state funds available to address the need. But as we talked about just a couple of minutes ago with the rental assistance funds, having the money isn't always the answer by itself. Getting that money out efficiently and effectively, I think, is really key to the solution as well.
Yeah, I mean, money isn't really valuable if people can't actually use it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cap Radio news reporter Chris Nichols, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Well, up next, we have a new look at where Californians stand on overarching issues, the recall, June 15th reopening, and vaccine distribution, plus a poem performed by the newly appointed National Youth Poet Laureate, and she's a Sacramentan. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Inside here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're getting a first look at a statewide survey gauging where Californians stand on the biggest issues facing our state. The Public Policy Institute of California's May statewide survey casts a broad net. They ask about the recall election, the latest chapter in the pandemic, vaccine distribution, the state of the economy, as well as sexual orientation and gender identity. The Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. Associate Survey Director and Research Fellow for the Public Policy Institute of California, Dean Bonner, joins us now to give us the latest in this report. Dean, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me. It's always great.
Well, Dean, how long does it take the PPIC to conduct a statewide survey like this? You do multiple over the year.
Yeah, so generally speaking, we do about 8 surveys a year. And at any given time, we're working on 2 or 3 at the same time. But generally, the fielding process is about 10 days. So we're in the field calling folks or online doing surveys for about 10 days at a time. But there's a lot of work in the lead up, choosing topics, making hard decisions about what to include and what not to include.
What does the May survey show in terms of the approval of the looming recall election?
You know, we find and results today are essentially the same as they were in March the last time we asked it. 40% support the recall, 57% oppose the recall. These numbers are nearly identical to March, as I said, and very similar to November 2018, when 38% supported John Cox. And so we really haven't seen a lot of movement either compared to March or even compared to 2018.
When it comes to the state of the pandemic, we're in or embarking on a new chapter with June 15th. What are Californians currently feeling about the state of the pandemic and reopenings? And has that changed since you began asking this question?
Yes, we've seen some large shifts in opinions even since January. In January, we saw that 59% of Californians were saying that the worst of the coronavirus pandemic was behind us. Today, that number is 90% among likely voters, and 86% among all adults. So that's a huge increase when it comes to how Californians are feeling about the pandemic. The share of Californians who are concerned about getting the virus has also plummeted, where today there are far fewer people saying that they're concerned about this. Californians are very upbeat about vaccine distribution, where we've seen 20 plus point increase in the share of people rating that as excellent or good. And so overall, Californians are viewing the state of the coronavirus much more positively than they were in January, and especially if you look back to last May.
When it comes down to relief, the governor has proposed to provide Californians with another round of stimulus checks and also helping with overdue rent and utility bills. We talked about affordable housing in our last segment. What are Californians saying about that?
Californians, as they have consistently, are very approving and supportive of some of these policies that the governor has put out. We found that 7 in 10 favor another round of stimulus checks, and even a higher share, 8 in 10, with bipartisan agreement saying that they favor assisting Californians with utility or rent assistance for those who have fallen behind during the pandemic. Of course, this comes at a time where the governor has lauded a $76 billion surplus, where we find that Californians are the share of Californians calling the state budget situation a big problem is at a historic low, with just 36% holding that view. So Californians are very optimistic about the state budget situation.
Despite that optimism, your survey found that 3 in 10 lower income residents, those are individuals making less than $40,000 a year, they feel that they're worse off financially than a year ago. So that really hits home to the topic of a wealth gap. What were you able to find in your survey about views on a wealth gap within the state?
Sure enough, we continue to find about over 6 in 10 Californians think that the gap between the rich and the poor is getting larger. There's bipartisan agreement. There's agreement across income groups that the gap is getting larger. Interestingly, lower income folks are much less likely than upper income folks to recognize that this gap is getting wider. And while there is a lot of agreement on this, there's also agreement that the state should be doing more. However, there's not bipartisan consensus on whether or not the state should be doing more.
That was also interesting is that you surveyed civil rights, including sexual orientation and gender identity. Of course, this follows the Supreme Court's ruling extending protections of the 1964 Civil Rights Act last year. It expands now to lesbian, gay and transgender Americans. And there's currently some legislation at the federal level that is in the House, may go over to the Senate. What are Californians feeling about the 2021 Equality Act?
So the 2021 Equality Act, this is kind of a new area of exploration for us. And what we found is that 7 in 10 Californians are supportive of this act, which is currently awaiting Senate approval. So we'll have to see what happens there. But most Democrats support this, nearly 2 in 3 independents support this, and 4 in 10 Republicans support this. And so it's a wide-based support, although there is a little bit of a gender gap with 3 in 4 women compared to 2 in 3 men supporting this. So overall, Californians are very supportive of the act.
What I also found interesting, sticking with, kind of the national scale, is the approval of President Biden. Californian voters have an approval rating that is larger than the national approval ratings. But what's so interesting was how starkly those views break along party lines.
Yeah, this idea of a hyper partisan divide has been consistent over, especially the last 4 years, where we saw, this large divide. And with 2 in 3 Californians approving of President Biden, that includes only 1 in 5 Republicans 6 in 10 independent and nearly 9 in 10 Democrats. So it's this really strong partisan divide. And what we saw with President Trump is that this divide was persistent and that the approval was pretty consistent over time. We'll have to continue to kind of gauge support for Biden, but thus far, his approval has been similar in January and in March and today.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at that, I think it's just worth repeating. 88% of Democrats in California approve of the president, 21% of Republicans. That's a huge gap. How do these results from your surveys get to state lawmakers?
So we have a great outreach with state lawmakers through our government affairs office, as well as the president and CEO, Mark Baldessari, meets with every new legislator when they come into office. Those meetings normally occur in person. During the pandemic, they've been occurring regularly over Zoom calls. And so this is something that we really value, that the survey is trying to provide a voice for all Californians. And that voice doesn't really matter if you're not kind of impacting policy. And so we're trying to get these findings into the hands of lawmakers, both at the state level and at the federal level, where we have outreach as well to California's congressional delegation.
What are the demographics of those who you're surveying?
Well, our demographics mirror the demographics of the state. So we weight by party registration. So our registered voters look very much like the registered voters and from the, you know, data from the Secretary of State. We also make sure that the regions are representative to the population, the most recent population numbers from the U.S. Census. And so as well as other things, like we weight by gender and education as well. And so these are things that, you know, are very important in a poll, that you're sample is representative. And, you know, for the most part, it tends to be representative, but we make sure through weighting that things are really dialed in.
And you mentioned that you do several of these surveys within the year, I believe it's 8. What makes this specific survey, the one in May, different from the ones conducted throughout the year? What stands out to you?
Well, the May survey generally has a budget focus. It's a little bit different during the pandemic and because of our kind of timing of the release of this survey. But the May survey gives us the opportunity to kind of look at the budget, but to also to continue to track Californians' overall mood about the direction of the state, the direction of the country, and just kind of the topics of the day. And so it allows us to ask about issues like the Affordable Care Act, about gun policy, whereas our surveys that we generally have in, say, April or July, which are specific to education and the environment, are very issue specific. Our Californians and the government and their government series are very broad based. January and May are more budget focused, but overall it allows us the opportunity to kind of ask kind of whatever's the important topics of the day.
Dean Baumer with the Public Policy Institute of California on the latest statewide survey of Californians and their government. Thank you for joining us again on Insight.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The very first time the nation named a youth poet laureate was in 2017, when Amanda Gorman was honored with the title. Gorman has gone on to perform her poetry for the Obama White House and more recently at President Joe Biden's inauguration and at the Super Bowl. We now have a new National Youth Poet Laureate, and she is Sacramento's own Alexandra Nguyen. The 18-year-old is a recent graduate of Mira Loma High School and is headed to Stanford this fall. Alexandra joins us now to talk about just this massive accomplishment. Alexandra, welcome to Insight and congratulations.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I think let's start off from the beginning. When did you first get into poetry?
Yeah, I have been writing songs since I was around 7 years old. And I wrote songs for group projects and I shared them in class. So I did kind of have a reputation for being the girl who turned the most ordinary things into something shareable and creative. But it wasn't until my junior year in high school when I entered my first ever poetry slam with Sacramento Area Youth Speaks that I really got launched into this world of youth poetry. And I really just remember walking out of that first poetry slam and thinking to myself, I can't believe those people are so supportive and that they actually want to hear what I had to say, because I wrote my first poems just, and I continue to write my poems based on what I see in my own life. And for that to be enough to hold people's time and attention was really special to me. And it empowered me to keep going forward.
You're a second generation Vietnamese American. Poetry is also tied to identity and belonging. How does this shape your work and your art?
Absolutely. I think that growing up second generation, I was kind of traversing the line between being fully Vietnamese or fully American. And I didn't really have a framework to see myself in the spaces that I was operating in. So my education, for example, very much felt like all of the stories were written in the context of whiteness. And poetry for me was a way to find my own place in the world by acknowledging my feelings and why I feel them, and then imagining a world where I feel like the people that I love and where I feel like I can thrive.
In the past year, so much has gone on, especially during the pandemic. Where did you find inspiration over the past year?
Yeah, I would say that I found inspiration in my community. I just felt very empowered by seeing so many people show up for their communities and, you know, really waking up every day hoping to do something good. And whether that means volunteering at the food bank or hopping on a Zoom call to give your friend emotional first aid, I think the people that I surround myself with very much motivate me to continue to show up for the people that I love every day. And that manifests in my poetry by trying not only to really bring light to issues that are important to me, but to also light a way forward and to offer a sense of hope in every space that I'm in.
And congratulations on going to Stanford. I think with that, I think about just being a high school student during this time. What lessons did you learn from quarantine and distance learning?
Yeah, I realized that I was not as self-confident as I thought I was. And what I mean by that is before the pandemic, I tied a lot of my identity to the activities that I did and the ways that I spent my time. And without all of that external validation, when I was left with myself, I realized that I had no really strong conception of who I was, what made me happy, and what I wanted to do. And this reflection time at home has provided me with a great foundation to be able to carry this role forward and to move into college with a stronger sense of self, because I now know that at the end of the day, all I really want to do is to have access to an education and a community and to be able to use what I've learned to help my community.
Well, and that all led to this amazing milestone in your life. How did you become one of the poets in the running to be a National Youth Poet Laureate?
Yeah, it's been a crazy journey. To be eligible for the National Youth Poet Laureate, you first have to hold a local title. So I was named the Sacramento Youth Poet Co-Laureate in 2020 with another amazing poet, Cloudy. And that allowed me to apply for the national competition this year. So I submitted my application in November, and I found out I was a finalist to represent the Western region of the United States. And just last week, wow, I learned that I had become the National Youth Poet Laureate out of the four finalists.
I mean, how did you feel when you found out?
It was a surreal moment. I remember in my freshman year of high school, that was when Amanda Gorman was named the inaugural National Youth Poet Laureate. And I had read a news article about it and thought to myself, oh, that's so cool. And then I moved on, because at that point, I hadn't really considered poetry to be something that I could do full time. And just being able to stand exactly where she was 4 years ago is mind-blowing, because it's made me realize that the distance between me and the people that I so greatly admire isn't that great. It's really just a matter of believing in myself and trusting in my community to help get me through it.
I mean, Amanda Gorman really just amplified the spotlight and the importance of poetry mm-hmm. just in the past year. And it's obviously someone you look up to. Have you had a chance to connect with her at all?
I have not, but I really am hoping to sometime soon. She's absolutely amazing. I'm incredibly grateful for all the doors that she's opened up, because she's really shown me that there is no space where poetry can't exist. And it's even more exciting because I realize that she is just one figure in a long and exciting movement of poets that will continue to extend beyond our lives.
When it came to becoming one of the poets in the running for this honor, where did you find your inspiration for the work that you were submitting?
Yeah, I drew a lot from the relationships that I have with my family. And a lot of my work, I would say, is based in place. So based in Sacramento, what I've observed in my community, but also with a lens for social justice as it relates to climate change. I have two poems in the portfolio that I submitted, one of them about food insecurity and the other about the fires in California in juxtaposition to the flooding in Vietnam. And for me, poetry is a really, really wonderful tool to humanize issues that are too often reduced to just quantifiable measures. And I particularly want to use it to highlight the climate crisis, because it's an issue that our generation has had to inherit. And to be able to mobilize as many people as possible to stand behind this issue and try to solve it in our lifetime is really important to me.
When it comes to being the 2021 National Youth Poet Laureate, what responsibilities do you have?
Yeah, in general, my responsibility is to serve as an ambassador of youth voice and to really teach youth that poetry can be used as a tool for social justice as well as self-actualization. So for me, what I want that to mean is to make sure that I'm never spending more time performing than I am teaching in classrooms. There are certainly going to be so many amazing speaking engagements that I'll have the opportunity to go to. But at the end of the day, what really pushes me forward is being able to have those one-on-one connections with youth and to be able to write with them. Because if I'm only able to touch one student every day, that would mean the world to me, because I want to reach kids who in particular don't think that they are the kind of person to be a poet, whether that means they don't feel like their words are pretty enough or that they don't feel like their lives are interesting enough. I want to teach them one-on-one that your words really do matter, because no one can tell your story quite like you.
And building that confidence. You know, finally, before we get to actually hear your work, any final thoughts on how you hope your poetry will touch others?
I hope that people are able to find a home in my poetry and that my vulnerability empowers them to put language to some of the darker parts of themselves, or even to radically hope for a better future. And I also want to encourage people to continue writing and sharing your own stories, even if you feel like no one can relate, because you as a person deserve to be spoken for in this world in your own words. And I promise you, someone out there is waiting to hear exactly what you have to say.
All right. Can you send us off with a poem?
Absolutely. This is called Autumn Prayer, and it's about a world that I hope for in our education system. It is here I receive all news, old news of the world, not my own, but with a passable scent from an old man with passable pity. He tells me about unit title, lesson number, and I swallow until he mentions Vietnam, the war. That is when I really start to listen. If I can't be heroine, call me ornament immigrant. Oh, the boats and the people on those boats, so brave, so different from the refugees now. We owed them. I moisten my tongue. at the sound of almost home, as the name Yung Thu Hung loses its river in my teacher's mouth, and no one asks why my face is wet. And remembering my one sad desk in the desolation of that classroom, I write a prayer for the children who fill it next. Let the children speak their names as their mothers do. Let the chorus sing it back, or try and try. Let the stories have no accent and some sounds remain untranscribed. Let the children fill the space with memory. Yes, the coriander. Yes, the silk. Yes, the stomp. Yes, the beads. Yes, the duplex. The asphalt. Yes, the drum. The honey. Yes, the incense. Yes, the white bread. The sneakers. The stars. Yes, the chain link. The copper. Yes, the river. The curls. Yes, the ballads. Yes, the bells. The cable buzz. The clay. Yes, the multiple. The many. Yes, the love. Yes, the love. Let the memories be told by the hearts they tumored. Let the children know their melancholy's name. Let them shape the vowels into hope and draw from ancestral hymn. Let honor make no hostages of them. Let their bloodlines become primary text and let what they've seen become their language. Thank you.
Thank you so much. National Youth Poet Laureate Alexandra Nguyen, thank you for your inspiration and for touching the lives of others. And I'm just so excited for the years that you're going to be embarking on a lot of success.
Thank you so much.
Well, still ahead, Music in the Mountains is celebrating their 40th anniversary. We'll have their Summerfest live this year after a cancellation in 2020. And we're going to have all the details coming up. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, as the state prepares to open back up in a few weeks, many are preparing for live music and gatherings. For those of you in the foothills who enjoy classical music, Music in the Mountains is gearing up to bring live classical music to everyone next month. With the Summerfest coming up, the organization is not only celebrating a return to normalcy, but also the 40th anniversary since Music in the Mountains began. In-person workshops have already been held for kids with social distancing measures in place to keep the students and staff safe. Artistic director and conductor for Music in the Mountains, Ryan Murray, joins us with more on the upcoming summer season. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I'm here in Sacramento. It's just about an hour drive away, going up to the foothills and Grass Valley. Can you kind of set the scene and paint the picture of the arts and culture scene in Nevada County?
Sure. It's an amazing place for music and arts. You know, I also live in Sacramento, so it's just a short hour drive up the hill. And it's a place that has fantastic choirs and orchestras and theater, and it's just a really thriving arts scene. And it's absolutely one of the most beautiful scenic places that you can go to as well. So if you're looking for something to do on a weekend when it's hot in the valley, you can go up the hill. It's a little bit cooler, hear some great music, and see some beautiful scenery.
South Fork of the Yuba River is my favorite river. And you just take I-80 up to Highway 49. When it comes to Music in the Mountains, what do you have planned this summer?
So we have five concerts coming up. You know, last summer we shifted from live concerts to virtual concerts, and we produced a lot of virtual concerts and did that whole thing, and now we're really excited to be going back to live music. Our first three concerts are with chamber groups featuring our chamber brass, chamber strings, and chamber woodwinds, and then we've got a string orchestra concert on July 1, and then we're ending our festival with Happy Birthday USA on July 3rd at Western Gateway Park. It's a patriotic pops concert.
You know, and we have reported on just how hard hit the arts community has been hit, you know, over the past year with the pandemic. How did things specifically shift for you when COVID shut everything down?
So a lot of things changed for me. The first thing was that I was driving a lot less, so I was spending a lot more time at home. But I quickly learned how to use modern technology to bring music to more people. So I started editing multi-track videos. I started learning how to broadcast on YouTube. So we actually did our entire 2020 Summerfest broadcast live on YouTube. And we actually, for some of our concerts, reached over 4,000 people, which is a lot more than we would do in a live venue. So although it was a challenging time, and certainly a hard time for musicians, we were able to give work to some of our musicians and our orchestra and to reach our community and keep our community together. So we were really excited about that. And we're even more excited about bringing everybody together for a live concert.
I mean, even when it comes to planning something like this, there was so much in limbo over the past year. How did you work with musicians just to gear up logistically for the upcoming Summerfest, not really knowing what was going to be possible?
Sure. So we decided that it was best to plan on the smaller side of things, or on a safe plan that we knew would probably be okay to go. You know, it looks like now in the next several weeks, things are going to be opening up even more. But we wanted to make sure when we were planning in March and April that this was a festival that could go forward. So we worked with our groups to make sure that everything was safe and that all the logistics would kind of work. We met with our orchestra committee, and we created a safety committee with members of the orchestra and the board to really make sure that we were doing it right and everybody, both orchestra and audience, would feel comfortable with these concerts.
All right, well, let's hear a bit of music. Here's a clip of your orchestra playing the end of Dvorak, New World Symphony.
Great.
I can only imagine how many people are just excited to hear that live after the year that we've had. When did you perform this?
That was actually from quite a while ago. That was a 2013 performance.
And I would imagine you're excited as well to get back in there.
I'm just thrilled. I mean, I've been spending so much time in front of the computer. I'm really, really looking forward to connecting with musicians. And even more than that, you know, we love to perform and we love to play. But the thing that we really love as musicians is communicating with an audience. And that's the thing that we're really missing, you know, to feel the energy coming back to you from the audience and to be sharing that community of music is really exciting. So we're thrilled to be doing it.
When it just comes to the dates, when can people start enjoying music in the mountains and Summerfest?
Sure. So our first concert is on June 11th, and this is actually a dinner and a concert in one of the most beautiful homes and properties in Nevada County, and the beautiful backdrop of the mountains behind you. And then we have a concert each Friday. So June 11th, June 18th is our string chamber group. June 25th is the woodwinds. July 1st is a string orchestra concert. And July 3rd is our Happy Birthday USA.
Any idea how many people you're expecting to welcome?
Well, I can tell you that our first round of tickets for some of these concerts already sold out, and that was based on a more restrictive guideline. So we are opening up a little bit more and selling some more tickets, but I think if you're interested in coming up, you should definitely try to get your tickets soon, because I think that every concert is going to sell out.
I think that just kind of is indicative of where people are at right now and what people are looking forward to.
Absolutely.
What safety protocols have been in place just to keep you and the musicians safe during rehearsals, since, as we mentioned, everything was in limbo?
Sure. So we actually won't have any rehearsals until we get a little bit closer. But the plan is to have musicians masked and socially distanced. And we actually have had rehearsals with our youth groups masked and socially distanced outdoors. And we actually have an entire COVID safety plan on our website. So if an audience member is concerned about feeling safe in the concert, they can go to musicinthemountains.org and look up our COVID safety plan, which talks about how we're keeping our audience and our orchestra safe.
Our producer, Cynthia, wants to know, how does masking work with wind instruments?
So there's a couple things that you can do. And I also teach at Sac State. So we've been having in-person rehearsals at Sac State. And we have special masks that that stretch in the middle, you know, so you can open them a little bit and fit the mouthpiece in, and then the mask closes. Although the most recent studies seem to show that the amount of air that actually comes out of the instrument after you blow through it is fairly negligible. So
yeah, I mean, it just is one more thing on top of an already odd year.
Absolutely.
Well, just a couple months ago, Music in the Mountains hosted Grammy-nominated Amani Wins for a concert. What other groups are you hoping to host as concert season begins just to really ramp up?
Sure. So actually, this summer, we're only using musicians from our orchestra. So we wanted to, because our orchestra hasn't been able to play for a year, we wanted to feature them as much as possible. Going into next season, I'm sure we'll have some guest artists in again, but we did have some fantastic artists like Imani Wins and Tessa Lark and Gabriel Martins over the last season. But this summer will be a real feature of the fantastic, talented players that live up and down California and even some out of state as well from our Music in the Mountains Orchestra. Mm-hmm.
Anyone in particular that you're really looking forward to, or you think your guests are looking forward to?
You know, I'm looking forward to everything. They're all just a little bit different. The brass concert has some really old music from back in the 1600s to some arrangements of Duke Ellington tunes. So that's going to be a really fun concert. The string chamber group has this fantastic piece by William Grant Still called Danzas de Panima. If I had to say, as a conductor, I'm probably looking forward to Strings in the Summertime on July 1st, which is a string orchestra. I'll be doing more conducting there. And we've got some fantastic pieces by Mozart and George Walker and Florence Price. And so there's a great diversity of both types of classical music and composers this summer. And I'm really looking forward to introducing those to our audience.
As a conductor, what is your favorite song to perform?
You know, the answer that we always give is whatever we're working on right now. But I mean, I think for me, I have a really soft spot for operas. And so operatic music is kind of always my favorite. Like, I love conducting La Boheme and Carmen and these kind of things. But you become so absorbed with the pieces while you're working on them that it really is true that you just fall in love with whatever you're performing at the moment.
You know, you did mention youth groups when it comes to music. And I was looking at your website, you actually touch 5,000 students a year. Can you talk to us about those programs and helping advance music and creativity within our younger group of people?
Sure. So we have several different programs. One is the Music in the Mountains Youth Orchestra that we call MIMYO. And that is an actual classical orchestra where they learn about different kind of string music and wind and brass music and that sort of thing. Then we also do things like Summerfest workshops where we open it up to more musicians. We've done a lot of stuff on Zoom as well that's been open to a lot of different people in the community. We're partnering with Carnegie Hall for their Link Up program. And we're also doing a program this year called World Explorers, which involves singing and learning to play different types of world music. So we've got several different programs that are running throughout the year, some that are really targeted towards those that are studying classical music, and others that are more about exposure to the art form for people that maybe are not serious students of music, but they want to learn more about music and what it can do for them.
How were all of these programs impacted over the last year?
So, like you said, you know, everything just became more difficult. We kind of kept everything going. We also have a fantastic symphony chorus that I conduct, and our chorus obviously had to stop last March, and we decided to go ahead and jump right on Zoom, and we had almost 50 Zoom rehearsals over the last year with our chorus, and our youth orchestra went on Zoom, so we did virtual recordings and performances. And we actually found that although we want to be in person, there are a lot of things that we learned by having to work on Zoom and YouTube and ways to reach more of the community. So as we go forward, we want to make sure we don't lose that. And yes, we'll have in-person things, but we do want to be able to reach people who maybe don't have the access to come out to a rehearsal or the ability to be there in person.
I can imagine after the countless Zoom rehearsals, you know, actually rehearsing in person and seeing another artist and another musician is going to take on an entirely different meaning after the year we've been through.
I can tell you that we had an outside spaced out rehearsal with our chorus. And in the first three notes, most of the choir was crying. You know, it's just so powerful to hear actual sound coming back at you, you know.
Well, in just about 2 weeks, a lot of people are going to start enjoying all of your work. Thank you so much for joining us, Artistic Director and Conductor for Music in the Mountains, Ryan Murray. Thanks again for joining Insight.
Great. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.